Jesus to bring it abundantly. And we know that that means we can be filled with all that you are, all that we can be filled with that you are, and that your Spirit will move and teach us, and you will illuminate life, and you will give light to us. Light and life, as John says. In him was the light of man. Light shone in the darkness. May we be filled with that life, that the light shines in the darkness. God, we ask as we enter into these five chapters that you give us the grace, Father, to get as much done as you have set aside, and the joy of receiving and understanding, and Lord, looking at each chapter differently is the way you present it. We thank you for this section and this section, and we ask for grace. Grace for one another, and grace for ourselves, and the grace, Lord, to hear your voice. In the name of your Son, amen. Amen. Today is a hair up day. Chapter 31 is where we started. Where are we in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel? Who's fighting the Philistines?
Israel and the Philistines were against Israel.
Say that again, Grace.
The Philistines were fighting with Israel.
Okay, so explain to me all that is. If I heard that sentence, I really wouldn't know the parameters. So tell me, what does it mean that the Philistines were fighting with Israel? Who is Israel? Who are the Philistines? What do we know about them?
The Philistines were
the coastal people.
Sort of the
first
thorn in the side
first
of
Samuel 31.
Everything in?
Except for your very tip.
Well, this isn't supposed to be. Is there anything else that...
No, I think it's fine.
That hey, got too much hair to try and get it all under that thing.
So the Philistines were coastal people.
The Philistines were coastal people. So Philistia was right on the coast of the Mediterranean, wasn't it? As a matter of fact, because we're going to get into the next chapter, the Amalekites. Where were the Amalekites?
It was in
the promised land.
Well, so were the Philistines.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Gotta find my map.
It still didn't go in.
Put it up, and whatever's left over, we'll cut off.
Gee, well, look. You know how long it took to grow that thing? Okay. So they're with the Philistines. Go ahead. What is next to Philistia? It's not on your map. That's why I'm asking.
Right.
Ziklag?
That's a city. Philistia is a country.
Judah. Judah is next to
right. Well, that's technically no. It's the Amalekites. The Amalekites are there, almost the same thing, but next to them, and they go down into even further into the desert. The reason it's important, it's not on any of your maps, and we talk about the Amalekites throughout this whole thing here. So you need to kind of know where they were, but they moved around too.
Right, and it actually is on the one the borders of David's empire. It does show Amalek. Right there.
Yep, that's yeah. It. Okay, good.
What map is that?
That's the one headed the borders of David's empire.
Oh, okay. Well, the map we're supposed to use today.
Right.
Well, it's not that map.
No, so don't look at that one. Look at this one.
But that's good.
It was in the back. Just in the appendix.
Okay, so where are they? We've got the Philistines. We've got, so let's put the Philistines. And we have Israel.
Well, in verse 1. The men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa.
So they're on Mount. Where is that on our map?
To the north.
So we've got the Philistines and Israel fighting up on Mount Gilboa, which isn't anywhere near the Philistines. So they're moving all over the place. It's important we kind of get a picture of this. What did they do in chapter 31 that we wrote down, that we know of?
They killed Saul and
Jonathan. Jonathan and his two brothers.
Yeah.
And what did they do with them?
Their heads,
and they took them where? They took the heads where?
To the house of their idols.
Well, they took the heads to the temple of Asherah.
To carry the good news to the house of their idols. To the temple.
Right, and they took their bodies to the wall of Beth Shan. So, were they left there?
No.
Why?
Because the men of Jabesh Gilead went and got them and brought them back. And
that's important because we're going to talk, David is going to talk about them later. So the men of Jabesh Gilead took Saul and buried him. And the boys too. Burned them and then took their bones to under the tamarisk tree. So that's chapter 31. Chapter 31 starts in Mount Gilboa and finishes basically under the tamarisk tree. Any questions? What did you learn from that chapter?
Well, they were valiant men.
So the men of Jabesh Gilead were valiant men.
Yes.
So the reason I'm asking this is we're also looking at the baseline of character qualities. These men could have died doing this. They didn't just say, well, he's dead now. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Out of respect for the position, out of respect for who they were, they took them and buried them. Did they make a big thing to David?
No.
Pay attention to that.
Right.
Because we're going to see some arrogance as we go through here to people who want to be known for what they did or said they did. Okay, so now we're in 2 Samuel 1. Where are we?
Now they're at Ziklag.
They're at Ziklag. What is Ziklag? What do we know about it? Think back in your chapters that you've already studied.
Wasn't it in Genesis, the black was like a, where they built like a pagan temple or altar or something?
And whose country was that as we go on? Well, it would have been Canaanite. That whole area was Canaanite. Uh-huh. So it was the Philistine.
Right, it's close to Philistia.
Right. But we met Ziklag in the last few chapters. Do you remember what we did? Look at 1 Samuel 30, verse 16. 1 through whatever, but verse 16. About 1 Samuel 30. What does verse 16 say?
When he had brought him down, behold, they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing, because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah.
So who was doing that?
It's the Philistines are doing it, right?
Okay, so the land is the Philistines, and then who else is there in this land?
David.
Is there, but why is he there?
You want to read first verse? Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day. Then that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. They took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing them.
Okay, that's even later. So let's look.
Well, that was before 16.
David was there.
It's before 30, if that's what that says, verse 1. Mm-hmm. David, why was David there?
Well, in verse 8 of 30, it says, David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And he said to him, pursue them, for you will overtake them, and you will surely rescue all.
Okay, let's go earlier than that.
So David's living in 29.
What does it say?
Verse 8. That's when the Philistine armies were going out and they didn't want David to go with it.
Okay, yes, prior to that. Why was David even there?
He had taken his families. They'd taken their families.
Wasn't he serving the king?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, what was his nationality?
He was Philistine.
Okay.
So 27:1. There's nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines.
There you go. But this is his, and the king did what?
Verse 6, he gave him Ziklag.
He gave him Ziklag.
Yes.
So this is David's headquarters from this point on for a while. So when he starts out as king of Judah, he's in Ziklag. Now Ziklag is what? It's a Philistine town. So he's in sort of evil territory. But this is his city. This is where he leaves his family. This is where he comes back to after wars. Ziklag. Okay? The reason I say that is because what is verse 1 in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel say?
He remained today.
So we start out our chapter in Ziklag. Why? Because David went home.
That's where he lives.
So in chapter 31, we have Saul's men annihilated on Gilboa. And in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, we have David in Ziklag. So we're going to watch. And actually, last week we went through the people, so we're not going to go through it as much this time with the people. But this time I want us to see how they go from city to city and what that even means. Because there's meaning behind this stuff. Any questions so far?
Well, and
here it is, 1 Samuel 27:6. What the heck are we looking at there? Go ahead.
I don't know. But he had just returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, too.
Right. So who is David fighting?
The Amalekites.
And who was Saul fighting?
The Philistines.
Okay, so pay attention to that. We need to think about that. Because up to this point, why was David not fighting the Philistines?
Because he was living in
Because he was sort of amongst them. Yes, he killed Goliath, but then he had to run away from Saul. And where did he run? He ran
to the Philistines.
To the Philistines, which he thought were less of a problem than the Amalekites were the Philistines were less of a problem than Saul because why? I mean, why would that be true? Since he killed Goliath.
Well, David made an alliance with the Philistines, and he was I don't know what they call it. Fight for somebody else, you know, during the time. He was a hero.
But before he even got there, can you imagine having the gall to go into the Philistines when he's just killed Goliath?
It's been a while.
Goliath wasn't loved by everybody, huh? So you have the focus with Saul on the Philistines and David, because he went after David. And you have the focus of David, the Amalekites here.
And they might have held David in some kind of high esteem because he did kill this mighty man. And they might think, wow, yeah, we'll take him.
But they did not want him to go to war with
them. It seems to me that they're very hero-oriented. and just like that is everything.
Why? Mm-hmm. Why are these people all hero war oriented?
Because they don't look to God. One thing.
Yeah, and they've come out of, maybe haven't come out of it yet. They worship these gods, and a lot of the thought was, you know, that you were, if you were a hero, some of them were made sons of gods and stuff.
They were humans made into gods. They were very power oriented, weren't they? And David obviously had God on his side, and they knew it. They didn't turn to the God that David had, but they knew that God was on David's side.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the Amalekites, because you have this in your homework. What did you learn about them?
They were nomadic people.
Pardon? They were nomadic. Even though we can see where they sort of were.
And something about them being a problem for the Israelites from the time they left Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
They did.
Yeah, kind of
striving. Right. Which would have been women, children, older people.
Sick.
Whoever couldn't keep up, and they were killing them. Yeah.
God had something to say about that.
Yes, he did.
What did he have to say?
Well, they were going to be destroyed and wiped off the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm. He said that.
God said that.
So at this point, were they?
No.
Not yet.
They've been?
Yes.
Why?
So they
annihilated.
What was he supposed to do?
Utterly
destroy
everything.
Yeah. And he says he did.
Nope, he didn't. He lied.
He brought the king back.
Mm-hmm. He brought the king back and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatling, the lambs, and all that was good. For he wasn't willing to destroy them utterly. Why?
Because to him, they were good. But to God, they were detestable.
And who was the king?
Well,
Agag.
So the king of the Amalekites was Agag. Somebody want to look up Esther 3:1. I thought this was really interesting. I was kind of surprised it wasn't in your lesson. But read it when you get it.
After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him.
So as we get into the story of Esther, we have the arch enemy, which is Haman. And what is Haman? He is probably of the line of Agag. So here he is still. And what do we know? I mean, we're going to get into it, so I'm not expecting you to know this, but does anybody know what happens to him?
To Haman?
Yes, Haman.
Yes.
He was killed.
He was killed? Same way he was going to kill Esther's uncle Mordecai. Okay. It's just an observation. God is still taking care of it. Israel was supposed to have taken care of this. Saul was sent to take care of this. He didn't. The problem goes on. Haman hated Mordecai. Hated him. Gee, does that make sense? Okay, so what else did I want to see? So tell me the story of Saul's death. You've got a couple of versions. What does Samuel tell us? In fact, what does Samuel in 1 Chronicles 1 tell us?
He tells us the same thing as in 1 Samuel 31.
Which is what?
That Saul fell on his own sword, that he was wounded. And he fell on his own sword so that they wouldn't be able to save David, the Philistines.
Okay, so what is this Amalekite? And what the heck was an Amalekite doing on the top of Mount Gilboa by himself, just happened to come across Saul?
He was waiting to go through and take the spoil.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. Watching and waiting.
And when he found
crown,
what he found, bracelet. He thought he could get a whole lot more out of going to David.
He had a lot of nerve, knowing that David was battling gets all the people.
Well, what do we know about the Amalekites? There is no fear of God. What else?
In that case, I think it was a deceitfulness.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. For his own benefit. It was a deceitfulness for his benefit. Okay? So.
The enemy of Israel.
The enemy of Israel.
They preyed on the weak.
Pardon?
They preyed on the weak, you know, because it's kind of cowardly.
Well, can you imagine going through a battlefield with all those people dead? You have to have like a hard something going on in your soul.
Well, they knew that the Philistines would be back later to take the spoil, so he was getting in there first.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yep. And we don't know whether I'm assuming the body was no longer there, bodies were no longer there because they would have been taken. But I'm assuming that.
The bodies of Solomon?
No,
they came later and got the bodies.
Yeah.
Did they come back?
Because the crown and the armlet wouldn't have been there. Somebody else would have gotten it if they hadn't used the body. Mm-hmm.
No, the body could have been the next day because they came for them.
Okay, good. So what does David do with this Amalekite? I'll grant him. What did he say? On what basis does he take his life?
On his own account.
His
deception. He confessed he killed Saul.
Whether he did or not, really at that point wasn't the point, was it? He said he did. And within that, what was David's response to his statement?
He said, "How are you not afraid to stretch out your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed? How is it you're not afraid to do this?
Like nothing's going to happen to you?
Yeah.
There's going to be no repercussions? We already know about the Amalekites. There's no fear of God in them." So he wouldn't even know to have it occur to him. He thinks he's coming because who is Saul to David, he thinks?
An enemy.
Saul may have made himself an enemy to David, but was David Saul's enemy?
No.
How do you know that?
Because he mourned fast when he died. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was sorrowful.
Mm-hmm. But even before that, what
do
we know?
Twice,
right. He had multiple chances to kill him.
Yeah. Right.
He took just a piece of his robe.
In fact, you see him trying to re-relate to him, trying to give him every chance that there could be for it with Jonathan. I mean, Jonathan himself didn't really believe in the beginning that his father would hold that kind of long-term animosity. But what else do we know about Saul? When Saul was called to be the king, what did God do with him? Well, before that,
he had him anointed.
He anointed him.
By Samuel.
And also, the Holy Spirit was with him, too, wasn't he? Was that always true?
No.
When did that stop?
When Saul disobeyed God the second time?
Very specifically. The whole thing with Agag, it was done. There was no coming back. So we see him, but David still looked at Saul as what?
As God's anointed.
As God's anointed. Was he anointed by them himself?
Yes.
He was, wasn't he? Where was he anointed?
At his father's house.
At his father's house. So even though he was anointed, he was never released that Saul was not the king. Anything you want to add to that?
Number 18, the book of Jezhar or whatever. Where did you find that at?
It's just a history book, and I looked it up. And in fact, what is that, verse 18? It says, it's an adjective meaning straight, just, and right. The word can refer to something physical, such as a path, but more often it means right in an ethical or emotional sense, and agreeable or pleasing. Example of this includes what is right in God's eyes, and they have a lot of verses, or in the eyes of the people. It also means upright. Some people were considered upright, such as David. It's an ancient history book. It was called the Book of Jasher, or the Book of the Upright. And you find that in Joshua 10:13, and in our verse in 2 Samuel 1:18. So it was an ancient book, but it's not part of the Bible.
Okay,
it would be more, I'm making this up, but it would be more like the Talmud and the, you know, there's something that elaborates on it. So it's considered the Book of the Upright. It probably goes through and explains the acts of, but we don't have that book anymore. So
right.
It's gone. When he says that things were written in, that's so he doesn't have to elaborate. Well, we have the things that are written in Chronicles. We don't have the things that are written in the Book of Jashar. Good question. I even looked it up. So in chapter 1, we get to a lament. What is the lament about? What do we learn from it? Since that's was kind of what you were looking at there.
Well, it's
lamenting over Saul and Jonathan.
He's lamenting over Saul and Jonathan. What is the key verse, or the key wording that he says three times in that?
Well, and that's a phrase that you'll hear sometimes, and people don't even realize that they're quoting the Bible when they say phrases sometimes that come directly from the Bible.
What does it mean? When you see that, when you look at those places around there, what do you learn from how have the mighty fallen? What is in verse 19?
Your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places.
So what's that talking about? And this is not talking about the spiritual high places where they had false gods. What is their beauty?
Is it talking about Saul being God's anointed?
God's anointed. Maybe what Saul stood for. Israel was supposed to be what?
Mourning.
But Israel was supposed to be obedient to God, to sitting at the feet of God, learning from God. We see with David in this section, we look at every time there is a possible battle or a place to go, what does David do?
He asks the Lord what to do.
He prays. He asks the Lord. He talks to him. Do you want me to do this? How do you want me to do that? Do you want me to do it now? Yes? No? What? Do we see that with Saul? But Saul was the promise. It's like the beginning. You know, there are verses in Proverbs, and I've always thought about this when you look at young people who are sort of at the beginning of their adult life, not quite there, and you can tell that God made them beautiful. I'm not talking about pretty faces. I'm talking about the promise of what they can be, the promise of who they can be. And what does this verse tell us with Saul, who could have had everything? How your beauty, O Israel, because who is Israel? Is slain in your high places. It's done. And it shouldn't be. And that is a point for lamenting. That's what he starts with. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets, that Ashkelon or the daughters of the Philistines will rejoice, the daughters of the uncircumcised will exult, which is even more horrifying. They're exulting in that which should have been that never was. O mountains, the daughters of the uncircumcised will exalt. O mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor your fields of offering. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. What's that talking about? When was a shield anointed with oil? Think about it. When would a shield be anointed with oil? Before battle and after battle. Right. Exactly. Because why would they do it before the battle?
To protect.
And to prepare it. And probably make it kind of shiny.
Protect, you know, spirit kind of a... This is anointed and will protect the one who's bearing it.
And they're taking time and control and doing what needs to be. And afterwards, because it's a mess. you know, your shield and your sword are a mess when you come back from a battle. So,
so is it similar to our troops today that they clean their rifles,
yeah,
get them ready, and then afterwards you have to clean them?
So when they start out, they're all ready for battle. It is in a take out the war part. It's a beautiful sense of the power and the strength of a nation. The beauty of watching this go off. Now, yeah, go ahead.
There's a cross-reference for Isaiah 21, verse 5,
right,
talking about, they set the table, they spread out the cloth, they eat, they drink. Rise up, captains, oil the shields.
Because what are they rising up for?
For thus the Lord says to me, go station the lookout, let him report what he sees. When he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, a train of donkeys or camels, let him pay close attention, very close attention.
So it's the same picture you have in the New Testament of the virgins when he says, go prepare your what is it called? Your oil, your be ready for he who's coming, your lantern. So get the oil in, have the wick ready, be ready. And five of them will be, and five of them won't be. And what's going to happen to the ones who weren't, who didn't plan, who didn't think ahead, who didn't prepare?
The light goes out, we can't see it.
And I can't share my oil with you because I was to be preparing because God told me, meaning whoever we are, God told me to prepare. And it is, even in that, it's a picture of salvation. I can't share my salvation with you. I need to be prepared for the Lord. I need to have focus on Him. This is the same thing. They're waiting until, they should be waiting until God says, go. Until God says, go. Any questions? So he talks, I thought it was an interesting verse in verse 23. That Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life. I even looked up the word pleasant thinking maybe it had a different meaning, but it didn't. And their death, they were not parted. Pleasant to whom?
Each other.
I think so. Because Saul wasn't too pleasant to David, was he? So they were pleasant to one another. But even that, Saul was very angry at Jonathan for having that relationship with his son. Okay, and what about the daughters of Israel? What were they to do?
Weep over Saul.
Why?
He was God's anointed.
God's anointed. He clothed them personally, luxuriously, in scarlet. They put on ornaments of gold on their apparel. In other words, he took their nation up in front of other people. And then again, here we have how the mighty have fallen. What does it tell us about the mighty have fallen there?
In the midst of battle.
Midst of battle, and Jonathan is slain on your high places. So we have Saul slain, and we have Jonathan slain. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished? What is that talking about? What was their relationship?
That they loved each other like brothers. They were.
And how many wives does Jonathan have? In the end, quite a few.
Yeah.
I mean,
David.
David. He has quite a few. Do you think those women loved him the same way that Jonathan did?
Yeah.
Why? What kind of a love relationship is it between Jonathan and David?
A kindred spirit type thing.
Kindred spirit, two equals.
Mm-hmm. And you
choice.
Don't
they have a choice to mm-hmm. like each other. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe some of the women and wives are more politically mm-hmm. affiliated rather
right.
than
right.
love
right.
matches.
They're
just there because they have each other.
The only woman we know he had a kindred walk with was Abigail. And yeah, I think sometimes the wives were just simply procreators. That's what we have them here. We have an awful lot, and we don't even know where they came from.
And we don't see too many friends like that. Right?
No. No.
A lot of people try to use you for whatever reason. And
what did Jonathan do?
He was his friend.
He was his friend.
He always wanted the best for David.
He protected David.
Mm-hmm.
Even against his own dad.
Uh-huh.
he should have been actually the next king, and
right.
he let go of that, and he knew God had chosen David.
Because he knew it was what was important was what God chose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, but why was Abigail never, didn't become a wife?
She did.
Yeah,
she was his
second wife. Well, yeah. actually, because they always, a lot of places it says the concubine. He has two wives and
she. Well, actually, tell me about concubines. What do you think a concubine is?
She's not really a wife.
Well, she really is. But she's a second rate wife.
That's what I wondered, because it always just said, it would say his two wives and Abigail, concubine. So.
No, it doesn't call her a concubine, but what Abigail was the wife of the
Nathal.
The widow of the of Carmelite.
Somewhere in my scripture, I don't know which one.
I haven't seen that. Look it up for me. But okay. They were married, and she was considered by many his greatest asset. Mm-hmm. But
he had a relationship with Bathsheba that was a little different too, because he had promised Solomon the throne, and she was able to go into him. They had more of a relationship than you see with his other wives, at least mentioned.
Right, different kind of relationship. Well, he lost a lot because of her too.
Mm-hmm. She lost a lot because of him. Mm-hmm.
We all lost a lot because of him.
Maybe.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yeah. All of those things that happen. It's kind of amazing, because when you look at David, and we'll talk more about it when we get to that area, but when you look at David, he had an exemplary character until you hit Bathsheba. And so when we get there, we'll talk about why. But he, when it came to morality, he knew what was right in battle. He knew what was right. He knew, in fact... Well, as we look at this, when these men, and we talked about this a little bit last week, when you kill in battle, that's expected. When you kill after battle, even if it's somebody who was in the battle, that's not acceptable. Unless God sent you there. Who did God send? He sent Saul to take out Agag and the people. That was battle. He was very specific. But as far as just going and killing somebody, you don't have the right to do that. And we'll talk about that when we get to it, but we even looked up some verses on that. So, let's look at 2 Samuel 2. Before we do that, what did you learn in 1 Chronicles 2 that kind of added to the story? In verse 16 particularly, but... First Chronicles 2, verse 16. You have it all the way through there, because you're learning about the sons of Boaz, Obed, and Jesse. Jesse's sons. We'll find out David is the seventh son.
And their sisters.
And their sisters. What do we learn about their sisters?
Were Zeruiah and Abigail.
Different Abigail.
And the three, different Abigail. And the three sons of Zeruiah were Abishai, Joab, and Asahel.
So what do we just learn there that adds to our story?
They were his nephews.
Because
Zeruiah was his sister, right.
Okay, so then we move into chapter 2. And where are we in chapter 2?
David's asking of the Lord if he should go up to one of the cities of Judah, and the Lord says, go up. So David said, where shall I go? And he said, to Hebron.
So here he is there. So where has he been?
He's been in
Ziglag, and now he's going to Hebron. So he went up there with his two wives. That's where it says wives. I don't know where it says concubine. Ahinoam the Jezreelite and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. Carmelite.
What's the number of that that you're reading?
That's chapter 2, verse
2.
It's a 2:2:2. 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 2. And they brought David brought up his men who were with him, each in his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. So what does that tell you about Hebron? It's
more
an area.
What's the area?
You know, there are countries, but there are cities, like multiple cities within the countries, mm-hmm. and areas. It'd be like our state. We live in the state of Washington.
Or a county, even.
Pardon?
Or a county, maybe. Like.
Well, it's in Judah. It's eventually.
Right.
It's,
right.
To me, in my mind, it's like Seattle and all the around surrounding little towns.
Yeah, like North Bay.
Which is in Washington, which is in the United
county.
States.
To me, it's all Seattle.
We are not Seattle. That's all Seattle. We are not Seattle.
So what happens to David in the city of Hebron here? Verse 4.
The men of Judah came and they anointed him king over the house of Judah. And this is where they told him about the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul.
Right. Now notice the Jabesh-Gilead men did not come to David and say, look what we did.
Yeah.
So
is it the men that anointed him that told him? It just says they.
The ones who found out, yeah. Whatever that means.
It's all in the same verse.
Again, they didn't make a big deal about who did what. They
right,
just,
right.
It happened, and he got the information.
Well, and remember, in the Hebrew writing, the pronouns don't necessarily match the noun that is around it. Right.
Because it was all in the same verse.
Right. We in our English, that's the way we would do it, but it doesn't always happen.
In fact, the pronoun usually goes back to the last noun.
Yeah.
But in the Bible, you have to be real careful with that, because it isn't necessarily... It ain't necessarily so.
Yeah.
Okay. So he was anointed over the house of Judah. But what was he not anointed over? House of Israel. Okay, so that's going to come in another point. So we're in Hebron, or Hebron, depending on what you want to call it. And he has been anointed king of Judah. They, whoever they are, told David, saying, the men of Jabesh-Gilead buried Saul. So what did David do?
Sent messengers to the men.
Okay, and?
Find out the truth.
And what did he say?
May you be blessed of the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him.
Keep going.
Now may the Lord show loving kindness and truth to you, and I also will show this goodness to you because you have done this thing.
So we very specifically talk about may the Lord show loving kindness because they did what? They showed loving kindness to Saul, even though he was dead, and the boys. And what else? Loving kindness and?
Truth.
What else?
Goodness.
Are we learning about the character qualities that are important to God?
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, what?
Let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them.
Okay, so... then we come to Abner. What do we learn about Abner there, and who is Abner?
Well, he's a son of Ner.
Okay.
What else? Abner is Saul's army.
That's a cousin of Saul's.
A cousin of Saul, yeah.
You know, they keep going on and on with Saul, and he's dead though for how long?
Mm-hmm. That's an important character.
Mm-hmm.
But this is
first king.
Yeah. But until the tribes are united again under David, we're going to keep hearing about Saul.
Well, and Saul was what? What is it called? The house of Saul. The house mm-hmm. of Saul. What does that even mean? That means he was the progenitor. Genitor?
Mm-hmm.
He's the first guy.
Yeah.
And he will always be the first guy, just as David is the first guy in his line. Okay, so what we learned that he was a commander of Saul's army, and what did he do?
Took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim,
when Megan came over, he's come to this area, Gilead, Asherites, Israel, Ephraim, Benjamin, even over all Israel.
So he was at Manna, Mannaheim. Spell it for me, Grace.
Mahanaim.
So there's another place.
And that's up near the land of Ammon, as we see from our map, the map in Israel in the days of Samuel, the Smapo.
So he brought him over to Mannaheim. And he was made king over all of those, but basically what are all those saying? He's king over Israel.
I find it interesting that even though God had chosen and anointed David and his spirit had departed from Saul, they're still trying to hang on to that and passing down the line to Saul's son, and they're still
trying
to go forward.
Why do you suppose they
do that? I don't know, that mind boggles me.
I think it was the way the other surrounding ones, because they had dynasty.
So they were used to seeing it that way, right? What else did Abner not do?
He didn't inquire of the Lord.
Inquire of the Lord, you do it how?
Your own way.
And their own way was, this is where I've had my leadership from. I've had my leadership as Saul's commander. I want to continue with my leadership. So what do? I take Saul's son and put him in as the commander. Morning.
Right. And right from the beginning, they wanted to do it the way the other people around them.
Right.
Didn't they know that God had anointed, Samuel had anointed David? Because God asked him to do it.
Evidently, we
do
know they know that because Abner says it in just a few more verses.
Right.
Well,
so,
it just seems quite.
There was Abner war between Saul and David.
They continued
that.
Right.
You know, Saul said to Abner, if I die, anoint my other son.
No,
David.
Even if he didn't say that, that was his seat of power.
That was his seat
of power. If he went to David, what might he lose?
His position.
Right.
Yeah.
So, again, with the Amalekites, why did the Amalekites kill the anointed of God? Because they had no fear of God. So what do we know most likely about Abner? He had no fear of God. When somebody has no fear of God, which, by the way, is a character quality, what does that mean about them?
They play by a different set of rules.
Yeah, they're not going to care about consequences.
Why?
Because they have no fear of God.
Do they believe he exists?
I think so.
Probably.
I don't think they do.
I think
that when you look at our politics, you get a perfect example. How many people say, I'm praying, or pray for our country, and you look at their lives and you go, my first question always is, who are we praying to? Seriously. If we do not bend the knee and submit our heart to the God of heaven, to the God who brought us Jesus, to the God who is the creator consistently and faithfully, the Lord is our banner. I mean, we go through all of this in these verses. If we're not submitting to him on his term, do I believe he exists? Because he says there will be consequences for not following him. And if I believe that, I may be messed up, but I'm heading towards changing because he said it and I believe it.
So Abner had to know, he knew that Samuel had anointed David, that God's spirit had departed from Saul, and yet he followed Saul still. And I could see that because Saul was still like the reigning king. But when Saul died, that loyalty should have just stopped.
And then his cousin as well. There was just a lot, I'm sure.
A lot of relatives.
So when it didn't stop, you have to ask yourself why.
Yes.
And we're conjecturing when we say that. You understand that? Mm-hmm. We're making conjecture. My conjecture has to be, from my perspective, that he didn't believe. Mm-hmm. Because, how many people have you known in your life who called themselves Christians and lived the way they wanted to? I have to say, how can you say you're a Christ follower? And that lordship thing, you don't have to do that. All you have to do is believe.
be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is be a good person.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Whatever that is.
Yeah,
right.
Whatever
compared
that is.
Hitler.
Yeah.
Compared to Hitler.
Yeah.
Right. They were in a land, everybody had different gods.
They did what
and
was right
so
in their own eyes.
Whoever was winning, that must be the god you want to follow.
Because what is their god? The god of power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was just curious, did the Amaleks like acknowledge that there was a god that at least was looking over? I mean, they at least acknowledged that there was something going on over on the other side.
You have to look up all the place where it says the Amalekites. If we have Agag and we have Haman as some of the examples of the Amalekites who are specific, I'd say no. But I do know, too, that when you look at those areas and you... Well, let's look, for instance, at Rahab. Rahab was, by the way, an Amorite. So she looked at what was going on with Israel, and what was her response? She worshipped other gods her whole life.
She knew God was doing something.
She knew God was doing something. She was willing to leave everything to know that God.
Well, and she'd kept all that, because the things that she says that had happened, they had happened a while
ago.
Way
back.
And she had kept those and was thinking about that her whole life and pondering that.
And she says that God is powerful. Mm-hmm. That's the real God of power.
Yeah.
And here he came to her door. You know, so what that tells me is that God was answering her prayer. Because... you hear about this all the time when people go into a new country where nobody knows about the book or Jesus, and they're waiting for the book, or they're waiting for the white God, whoever that is. They don't know. They don't have a clue. But they know in the history of their nationality that this is coming. So God prepares people, and I think we don't fully understand that, but we need to pay attention to. There are many missionary books that talk about things like that. So I think with here, he had prepared her by the stories that had happened. What she said was, when you came out of Egypt, we know that your God
right.
is real.
And she doesn't just say, I know. She says, we have heard.
Right.
We
so who responded?
Yeah.
Just her.
Yeah.
Just her. So does God... go all the way to one country for one person.
Yep.
He does.
Well, wasn't her family protected too?
Yeah.
Well, they were because of
her. In the line of David.
This is like in the picture of the Philippian jailer. Same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but that doesn't mean they're saved because of them. They're saved when they respond to the.
Just
to
like
the truth.
Lot and his daughters. Mm-hmm. Well, they don't get out of the city, but what happened afterwards on their own.
So as we think about character qualities, what did you learn about the character here?
Character who?
Just what did you learn about character qualities? When you're looking at Abner?
Well, later we'll...
Even Ishbosheth. We're going to look at Ishbosheth.
And he was kind of... Yeah.
But what do we know? What did David call him?
He was anointed too.
What?
He was anointed too, wasn't he?
Well,
son of God.
He wasn't anointed by God.
Right.
What did... Well, let's follow the story and we'll write it down when we get to it. Okay, so... Yeah, how you get through all these verses. Okay, so in verse 12, Abner the son of Ner went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon, and the servants of Ishbosheth the son of Saul, and Joab the son of notice they use his mother. Why did they use his mother's name? They usually say the father's names.
Maybe to let you know the connection with David.
Because of the connection with David. And the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. Okay, so who was at the pool of Gibeon?
Abner and
Joab.
The servants of
And then Joab and his and the servants of David.
Exactly. And what are they going to do there?
Have a contest.
They're going to have a contest. I've run out of space. So you just have to write if you have a list. What is a contest? And what do they do in this contest?
Kind of like a duel type thing.
Well, literally it means to make sport. But in those days, that's how they did sporting events.
It also could have been like having a party. Verb meaning to laugh, to celebrate, to rejoice, or to mock. And it means to play a sport, to hold a contest or a match. Okay, so what was the outcome supposed to be? We think of Goliath. Why did Goliath just take on one guy?
To spare, like, many dying.
So, and they didn't believe that anybody was going to beat Goliath. But it was supposed to be to eliminate the big battle thing. Which means their guys weren't going to die, because whoever was coming against them surely would die. So you have this, and you have 12 for Benjamin, which is Ish-bosheth, and 12 for the servants of David. And what were they supposed to do, or what did they do?
Thrust
into the
head, thrust
fell
down
to the side. So who lived?
Looked like
nobody lived. They all died. That was the end of that. Except then they went right into a war, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they didn't. And it says in verse 18, the three sons of her three sons were swift footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field, and Asahel pursued Abner. Why?
Because they had killed his brother.
Mm-hmm. Well, the battle was pretty severe. Abner and the men of Israel were beaten, and so they were fleeing away because they were beaten. And I think young Asahel thought, I'll catch up with Abner and kill him.
Because he's what?
He's a commander.
Because he's a commander. Yeah. Right, so he stayed on in his track, which is what you do in a battle, right? Okay, so he did, and Abner looked behind him, and what did he say?
Is that you?
And he said,
It is.
And what else did Abner say?
Quit following me.
Well, and he offers him, go kill one of those other guys instead. Isn't that so kind?
why would he say that? Because if it's blood you want, you can have blood.
Yeah.
Just not mine.
And he would take the spoil.
Because he's going to have to deal with his brother.
Yeah,
well, this other guy's gained and more evenly matched. Yeah.
Well,
I thought it was kind of big of Abner to actually say, quit following me. If you don't, I'm going to kill you. He gave him a warning.
Yeah, he did.
Which I thought that was a pretty good character quality, really. Not that I'm thinking
at that point,
great,
for that statement.
That was something.
I think he
really rather not kill you. Skills.
But he says, go kill that guy.
Why did he want to kill him?
Because of dealing with his brother.
He knew that
because his brother would take up the battle, wouldn't he? So was that really a character quality?
It was a strategy
thing. It was his character quality.
Yeah.
Strategy. Yeah. Yes. But it wasn't a God strategy or a God character quality. But that tells us in war, as in politics, you make deals, right? Unless you're David, and then you go to God. So just watch the contrast there. Then Abner said... So they went down to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of all that stuff, in the wilderness of Gibeon. The sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner, and they became one band, and they stood on the top of the hill. At this point, Asahel is dead. And Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour us forever? What is he saying here?
We're going to kill each other off.
Should we keep on going? Shouldn't we stop? How long will we refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers? Because what are Israel and Judah? They're brothers.
And they have to fight the Philistines. And here they are killing each other.
Fighting each other. And the Amalekites. Joab said, as God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each of them following his brother. So Joab blew the trumpet, and the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. Was Abner done with him?
Well, he left.
But was he done with him?
Well, no.
Okay.
Obviously.
So they crossed the Jordan, and they walked all morning, and they came to Mahanaim. Okay, that was Abner. So Abner's back up here. Why would he go there?
That was the headquarters.
That's where Ish-bosheth is. Then Joab returned from following Abner when he had gathered all the people together. And then he counted, 19 of David's servants were missing besides Ashiel, and the servants of David struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so 360 died. Why are they keeping tally?
Well, to show the difference that, you know, David really had succeeded. He only lost 20.
Could be another reason that Abner quit the battle. And they took up Ashiel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night until the dawn at Hebron. So where did they end up? Where did Joab end up again? Okay, so he's in Judah's capital, and Israel is in their capital. Okay, so chapter 3. It starts out with telling us there's a long war. And what was the bottom line of this long war in verse 1?
Between the house of Saul and the house of David. David grew stronger, Saul grew weaker.
Okay. Who's observing this?
I think everyone.
Specifically Abner and Joab, yes? Mm-hmm. Sons were born to David in Hebron, and here it is. There is his list, and we see that he was there about 6-7 years. So there are his sons that came, and it's still his. He's come from Ziklag, which was a Philistine city. He's come to Hebron, which is now his headquarters, right? Okay, what do we know about Hebron? Where did it come out of? What was it called originally?
Well, all the names I can't pronounce.
Kiriath Arba.
It was given to Caleb.
Okay, it was given to Caleb. How old was Caleb when he got it?
In
his 80s, wasn't he? Was Caleb a, was he a Hebrew?
His
family was a family that came out of this area. He was a Kenite. Which is different. Canaanites are everybody. Kenite would be in that area. But he was incorporated into what part of Israel? Because he got this land because he is considered a tribe, or part of a tribe, but he's still a Kenite. What tribe?
Levi?
Judah. Which is why he got this spot of land. It had been promised to him from back in the beginning. Okay, and let's see how much do I want to get.
Then the Levites got a portion of it.
Yes, for what? So what was Hebron? What did Hebron become?
The city of refuge.
It's very, very important. Because we're about to hit base on that one. Okay, so Hebron was one of the cities of refuge. And it was called Kiriath Arba. Why? Because Arba was one of the greatest men among the Anakim. Who are the Anakim? Do we know who they are? They were giants. And the Rephaim came from the Anakim, and that goes all the way back to the other side of the flood. In fact, they often think that Noah's wife had Anakim blood in her, because they don't. Otherwise, how would it have gotten to the other side of the flood? They were descendants of the Nephilim, mighty men of old. Okay, so what else do we want to look at there? So you said Aaron, the son of the priest, were given Hebron for a city of refuge, and the man's there. Okay, so let's get to our story. There's a lot more that you could study in that. But we only have a half hour left, so we're going to be simple. Verse 6, there was a war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul, obviously. And then what did Abner do? In verse 7 from there. Who did he take?
Saul's concubine.
What is without going past the obvious, what is that story about?
power again.
Why is it about power?
Because you're taking of the king's things that were the king's for yourself.
So what does that say you are doing?
Assuming some of the power.
Taking the throne away from.
Or taking a challenge on. Who is he challenging? Ish-bosheth.
Yeah.
Ish-bosheth, from all that we can tell, is a very gentle-spirited man. He never went out to war. We don't see him going out to war. We do not see him being trained for war. Who was trained for war? Who was trained to be the next king?
Jonathan
was, not Ish-bosheth. So we kind of get him down the line a bit. So what do we think of Abner doing that to Ish-bosheth?
It's like they accused him, but he probably did it.
Well, it says they took it into his. They took him into his. Whatever his women were, but think about it for a minute. When we get the story, and they have the story in here of David when he was old and dying, and they bring a young woman into him. What was she? She was not a wife. He never had relationship with her. So it can't be because of that. But what did the nation look at her as?
His wife.
Somebody who belonged to her. Somebody belonged to him. So this young woman would have belonged to Ish-bosheth by passing on, taking care. It could be in a totally innocent way. He was taking care of his father's wives and concubines. So in that sense, she belonged to him, or he had a responsibility to her. You don't see anything there sexual, but you do see when he comes in and takes one of the women, he's making a statement. When Abner takes one of the women, he's making a statement, whatever he does.
But that's what I thought. Did Abner actually do it?
Yeah, because Ish-bosheth said, "Why did you do this?" And then he got angry at him. So,
well, he probably did.
Yeah. Ish-bosheth found out that after.
Ish-bosheth seem like a confronter?
No.
Yeah,
he
really,
probably was
really.
Forced to confront because somebody said he's trying to take your power away. Mm-hmm. And the reality that Abner, in my reading, kind of is like Abner was saying, "I am really the one. You're the figurehead. I'm the leader.
I'm the one who's won you this position. I'm the one who anointed
you." He's now
taking
that another step, so that Ish-bosheth would actually know that as well. Don't think.
Plus, if you hadn't have done something, wouldn't it have been appropriate to say, "Oh my Lord, I did not do that.
Right.
I would never." Do something to affront you like that, whatever. He instead got affronted. How dare you question me over a woman? You know, I mean, kind of get that.
I get the impression that Abner all the way through is, it's like almost, if they had the game at the time, he's playing chess.
Yes. In fact,
taking,
I think they all are.
Taking this pawn.
Outside of David, you get, they keep trying to figure out how to get to the position they want, or how to get what they want out of things. We saw that with the Amalekite. He lost his head and his hands because he said, "I killed him," even though he didn't. I mean, that's ridiculous. But he lost because of that. We're going to see that with the commanders, Ish-bosheth's commanders. Because who's going to kill Ish-bosheth? It's not Abner.
No, it's...
It's the two commanders.
Yes, it's commanders. It's kings.
So when you get this interchange between Ish-bosheth and Abner, Abner's saying, "You guys said it. You couldn't have this position if it wasn't for me. I've won everything for you, for your father, etc." So how much do I want to hit here? So in verse 12, David is going to make a covenant. Who is he making a covenant with?
Abner.
Why?
Abner promised
he can bring Israel.
So because he sees himself as greater than Ish-bosheth, and we do know Ish-bosheth won't make a big deal of this.
He's afraid of him.
He's afraid of him.
Yeah.
He's a simple. I think, you know, if it were today, I'd say he was the intellectual upstairs reading the books. Because we get the fact that he does do those kind of things. So He could no longer answer Abner a word because he was afraid of him. Abner sent a message to David, who is in the land, make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand will be with you to bring all Israel over to you. So he thought he could do that. And David said, sure, but what?
I want my wife.
Did he really want his wife? What do you think that that was about?
The same thing, really.
The same exact thing.
Yeah.
What?
You take your power. This is part of mine as Saul gave it to me. She's not, oh, I love this woman, I miss her, any kind of thing. It's like, no, she's mine. I want her in my house.
How did she get taken away from him?
Saul gave her.
So isn't that the same thing? Mm-hmm. Saul said, I will humiliate and shame you and take your wife and give him to another.
Yeah.
You get how wives were sort of the transferred shame here?
Yeah.
Used as tools?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
and at this point, we haven't seen how her response to him is going to be, but we do see what her husband's response was, and he mourned at the loss of her. So, but who brought Michael to him?
Ish-bosheth.
Ish-bosheth did. Why? Because remember, David is going to call him righteous.
Mm-hmm. He's a nice guy.
I think he knew that it was wrong.
Yeah.
Could he stand up to his dad when it was there?
No.
He couldn't, could he? So he's doing what is right here. And he says, I was betrothed for 100 foreskins. We talked about that last week. Did anybody find the answer to that?
It was 100.
It was 100, and the reason we thought 200 is because he killed 200 men to get the 100 foreskins. Why, I have no clue, but it was 200 men.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to even go further on that one.
During a battle, you can't go, oh, well, I'm done here.
Yeah, right.
It still might get killed.
So, well, he could have also, in just pure logical terms, he could have been trying to impress his father-in-law to be. I don't know. Ish-bosheth, but he was asked for 100. Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, and then what happened?
Husband didn't want to let her go.
But we don't see her response at all.
Yeah.
So Abner, in verse 17, consulted with the elders of Israel, saying what? This is how we know as
David to be king over you.
What, on what basis would he want David? Would he want David to be king over Israel? They wanted him. What else?
He only be working for David now.
So he brought in Benjamin and the rest of Israel. He went to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron and seemed good to Israel, to the whole house of Benjamin. They were for it. Why hadn't it happened earlier?
Because Abner wasn't for it earlier. So Abner had a lot of influence.
Yes, he did. Abner and 20 men came with him to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, let me arise and go gather all Israel to my lord, the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and you may be king over all that your soul desires. So have we ever heard that David's soul desired that? Is this an assumption? It's an assumption based on what? Abner's character. Mm-hmm. Abner was not with David in Hebron. He had sent him away and gone in peace. Joab and all the army that was with him arrived, and they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and the king sent him away, and he has gone in peace. And Joab was really happy. No, why not?
I don't want that guy around.
Why?
He's my brother.
And he's a deceiver, and he could take my position. He didn't say that. So what does Joab do?
Goes out after Abner.
Where?
Well, he sends messengers to him.
To bring him back.
He deceives Abner. He's coming back.
How did he deceive him?
He sent messengers to say, David wants you to come back.
Yeah. So where was Abner?
He was on his way back to
the well of
Before that, where was Abner?
Mahanaim.
In Hebron. What is Hebron?
Oh, city of refuge.
A city of refuge. What cannot happen in the city of refuge? So why did Joab send a message to him?
To bring him out.
To get him out of the city of refuge. And where did he meet? Where did Joab and Abner meet?
At the well of
Sira. Which is right by the gate. It's like he slipped through the gate and got him right there. That's why David says, what about Abner? Should Abner die as a fool dies? He did. He died as a fool died. Because if he'd have stayed in Hebron, he would have lived. Joab couldn't have touched him. So afterwards, when David heard about it, verse 28, I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and all his father's house, and may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, or one who is a leper, or takes a hold on a distaff, or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had put their brother to death in the battle of Gibeon. Right there in that verse, was his death a righteous death? Well, we don't like war, and I hate war, but according to the laws of war, was the death of Abishai righteous?
Yes.
Why?
Because
how do you know?
It was war.
He was because it was death in the battle of Gibeon. The battle spread out. It was still death because he was in a battle. Then David said to Joab and all the people who were with him, tear your clothes, gird, so on and so forth. And David, Abner and the king walked, lament before Abner, and the king, boy, David has to do all these laments. They buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king chanted a lament.
And he has Joab doing it also, which is kind of ironic for Joab. Joab should know, I'm in trouble. Yeah,
get the point here. And the king chanted a lament for Abner and said, should Abner die as a fool dies? Because exactly what did he do? He did. He sat at the gate ready to take his life as soon as he moved. Your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. And all the people wept again over him. Why are the people weeping?
Because David is.
Because David is, and this was not a righteous kill. It was not. It was not in battle. He murdered him. Abner took the life of Joab's brother in a battle that was righteous. Joab's vengeance upon Abner was not righteous. Okay.
Yeah, because I was thinking that what you had said.
I know I had a lot of things going on there.
Was that you know? Israel and Judah are always battling each other, so like it was a continual war. So as long as he followed the rules and got him outside of the town, that it was still considered okay. When I had first read that, I didn't think of that, but I thought that's what you had just said. I lose the name sometimes.
Yeah, I know. We go into situation after situation, and then he lied to him. I mean, I think that Abner probably thought Joab just wanted to talk to him.
Yeah. Oh. Or even the messengers are the ones that came.
Yeah,
could have even said, we don't know, but he could have said, tell him David wants to see him for something else.
Yeah, he's on his way back.
Well, and I also thought, I mean, aside from the righteous kill and all that kind of stuff, I thought David had a conversation with Joab and let him go in peace. David the king had said, or I mean, I'm sorry, let
Abner
go, excuse me. And David was Joab's king, and if the king said he goes in peace, he goes in peace, and he just decided on his own accord, nope, he killed my brother.
In fact, we know he didn't accept it, because what did he say? No, he's a liar.
Right.
You know, he's a conniver. Well,
so that just
even if he was, it was David who should have taken the brunt for that, and that's another thing we all have to learn. And what is hard, that's what's hard, being in a country, you know, in a country situation where you have leadership that's not godly or righteous. Your choices are either you stand up against it respectfully, according to the law, or you are silent, which is also not righteous, or you fight it on your own terms, and that's not righteous. So those are the things that we're learning from this. There are ways to do things, and there are responsibilities each one of us have. If they were against war, they should have stood up against war and taken the repercussions. I remember during the Vietnam War, many of my friends going as conscientious objectors and were willing. One of them went to jail, and a couple of them became medics. They still were standing respectfully loyal to their country, but they were not going to kill anyone. So
also taking the righteous stand to the degree you're able to, and then just trusting God and his righteousness is and meet that. You may not see the conclusion.
Right.
Your
absolutely
stance.
Not.
So it's just a matter of, yeah.
Right. And that's why we have to pay attention to how we're right, what was righteous in the Bible, and what did that look like, and how do I apply that to my own life? Then other people came to persuade David to eat bread, and so on and so forth, and it is very interesting. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel stood on that day that it had not been the will of king to put Abner, the son of Ner, to death. So Israel knew that David was an honorable king, and they could trust him because they're coming from their commander dying, right?
Right.
Let's see. Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. This is King David saying this. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. And was there anything you wanted to add? We sort of pretty much hit about the concubines and the wives thing. So chapter 4, unless you wanted to add something.
I was just impressed by the lesson that we learned in that there's no end to revenge. And
absolutely not.
And it just goes on and on and on. He kills him, he kills
So if it's been in your family for generations, what would your responsibility to end the revenge be?
Trusting God, don't take revenge.
Because vengeance is mine, thus says the Lord.
Yeah.
Vengeance is God's, yes. Not ours. It doesn't mean it doesn't need to be revenged, but it's not man's right to do, because God looks on the heart, man cannot. Okay, so chapter 4, we still have Ishbosheth. Saul's son heard that Abner had died, and what was his response?
Lost courage.
So where is this Ishbosheth?
He's still coming over and his kingdom up in that.
Okay, so he lost courage. All Israel was disturbed. Why?
No leader.
No leader. And the one that they have is pretty fearful. Not of God, but of man. Saul's son had two men who were commanders of the bands. The name of one, and so tell me about that story. I'm not going to go through all their names. Take 10 minutes. What do we know about these guys who were commanders of the bands? What do they do?
They go in and kill Ishbosheth in his bedroom.
To get the kingdom.
Well, because Saul had sent him to get him in.
They thought that they were
kind of
the enemy of David, so they were proud of what they did, just like the one that David killed Saul.
Same kind of thing, because then they go to David to show them that they are on his side. Did David ask him to do that?
No.
As a matter of fact, what's David's response? This still wasn't your right or place to kill this man. And we have a little interlude in there about Mephibosheth. What do we learn about who is Mephibosheth?
Jonathan's
son, about 5 years old, and what happens to him?
He is crippled. So Nurse tries to flee with him. So is he like going to be an heir or something, and she was trying to protect him by
Well, just if you're his nanny, don't you know they're going to come after you? She's pretty sure they're going to come after him.
Yeah.
Because he's the only heir.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's Jonathan's heir. He's not, he would be more of an heir than Ishbosheth would be, truthfully. But, so, we're there at the cusp. We have Mephibosheth, we have the brothers, or the whoever they are, who kill Ishbosheth, and they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. So we're back to Hebron. And why are we in Hebron?
Because that's the headquarters of David.
Okay. So, and in fact, he says, Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life, thus the Lord has given my lord, the king, vengeance. Did David ask for vengeance?
No.
So what's going to happen to these guys?
Anything that happened to the others?
David answered them and said, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress, and one told me, saying, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing me news, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when a wicked man have killed a righteous man in his own home, not on the battlefield, in his own home, in his own bed, shall I not now require his blood from your hand and destroy you from the earth? So what did he say about Ishbosheth? He was what?
Righteous.
A righteous man. So, so far in this, we have loving kindness, truth, goodness, and righteousness. These are the said things. There are more things that we have seen, like faithfulness, loyalty, and stuff, that are also there. So that's what you pull out when you read this. David commanded the young men, and they killed them, cut off their hands and feet, and hung them up beside the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the grave of Abner. Why do you think they did that?
They were together in life. Together.
And it was a grave that was already there, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, there you go. Okay, what did you learn about holding one accountable for murder or taking a man's life in your cross references? Is it an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? And if it is, on what basis?
Sheds blood. His blood should be shed.
So that's the eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. It's not vengeance, it's law. That's the thing that we have to understand. I don't have the right to take another man's life, but the state does. And on what basis?
That they took
a life.
Right. Well, and in Numbers 35, it repeats what God said back in when Cain killed Abel, the murdered blood, it pollutes the land.
Right.
Somehow, I mean, we don't understand how
that... It cries out for justice.
Right, right. But, yes.
It cries out for justice.
And we don't understand that, but God sees it differently, and he sees that the blood spills in the land, and the land, the earth groans, the earth cries out.
What are some of the most important things to God that he tells us to be in the New Testament? We are to be just and fighting for the justness
love
for
mercy.
All men, to love the widows and orphans.
Love mercy.
To love mercy.
Yeah.
Those are things God talks about. They're important to him.
Yeah.
So we need to pay attention to what that looks like. What, in the sense of somebody who dies and nobody knows who killed them, going back to your statement, and this is Deuteronomy 21, mm-hmm. What is a city supposed to do? So it's important. I think would a child knowing about this and watching this happen would see that a human life is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not understand anything. They may sob that the heifer was killed. But that human life is more valuable. Mm-hmm. Does our country believe that?
Yeah.
It's getting away from that, isn't it?
Yes.
It's getting into animals have as much rights as human beings. Okay, Samuel 5. We have 5 minutes. What do I want to get? So what happens to David here in Hebron?
all the tribes of Israel come and do what?
Make a kingdom.
Why? Why? So once again, they're back to being functioning as brothers. And you will shepherd my people Israel, you will be a ruler over Israel. Does he stay in Hebron?
Yeah.
So the Israel, the elders of Israel come to the king there, and he makes a covenant with them, but what does God do? Where does he move him to?
Jerusalem.
He removes him to Jerusalem, which is also called the City of David, which is also called the Stronghold of Zion, which is around the area of Milo. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord God of hosts was with him. So where is he going to stay? Where are his headquarters?
Jerusalem.
So he started where? He started at Ziklag. He goes to Hebron, because God put him there. But when they become united as one kingdom, then he goes to Jerusalem. I think that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then and he had some more sons born there. Another 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. A lot of kids. Anything you want to add from that chapter?
Well, he didn't go to Jerusalem immediately. He was in Hebron for 7 years.
Well, that's the whole 7 years, not seven more years.
When the Philistines learned that David was anointed king, then they went up to seek him out.
So we have a couple more wars, don't we? What happened there?
David inquires of the Lord.
David inquires of the Lord. First, should I go to battle? Second time, what did God say to him? In verse 23. And this was all in the valley of the Rephaim.
Circle around behind them.
Why?
It shall be that when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then you shall act promptly, for the Lord will have gone out before you and strike the army of the Philistines.
Isn't that a wondrous verse? I mean, thinking about angel armies are up there. You'll hear them. You may not see them, but you're going to hear them.
You can know that
I'm where you're going to hear them.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Anything you want to add from First Chronicles?
God said that he was going to utterly destroy the Jebusites, and that they were not, and realizing that in every case God did not want them to take the idols, and so he destroyed the altars, he took the idols.
So we're going to have to figure that one out, aren't we? Maybe they're getting a little puffed up too. Who are the Jebusites? Have we seen them in like Joshua and Judges and stuff?
Yeah.
We have. What do we know about them? They were so powerful that Israel or Judah could not wipe them out.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think it's because they took the idols.
And then Benjamin couldn't. They
still
tried.
No.
They couldn't get rid of them.
Caleb did a darn good job, however.
Did not.
But they're still there, aren't they? So something to pay attention to, and we come back next week. Yes, I have to think.
So, Kit, how does that work when God tells him,
He tells him what?
He told him that he would go before him.
Right.
The angels would go before him to drive out all these people out of the land. And then we see Judah couldn't overthrow him. Benjamin couldn't, so...
Why didn't all of the Amalekites die when God told them that he would?
Because they disobeyed him. They didn't do what he told them.
So one of the things can be disobedience. Another thing is the same thing, but it's coming from a different angle. Lack of faith that it could happen. Fear. I mean, Ishbosheth was still a child of God's, and would he have been prepared for battle? Why would he not have been prepared for battle? Because he was fearful. Well, that's another part of it. You pay attention to all of that, but it also says that we'll be wiped out forever. Do you know of any Amalekites today? So there is a point we're going to see them gone, but not in the time that God had it set aside for it. We see the same thing with the Amorites. With the Amorites, God said in Genesis 15 when he was making the covenant with Israel, I'm waiting for the sin of the Amorites to be full so that when you go in there, you have the right to destroy these people totally. But they didn't. So, you know, this is what we're watching. We are watching a people who have failed to trust God fully. And we can do exactly the same thing. And that's the point. As we think about these people, rather than condemn them, look in your own life and see, where has God shown me the sentence in my life and I have not fully given it to him? I have not fully let God be God in my life. And so what is our response then? When you recognize this, when God shows it to you, what is your responsibility?
To repent.
And to learn how to repent. Maybe you have something that you have done your entire life and struggle with dealing with it. Go to somebody else who's dealt with it. Come to the, you know, go to the front. If you have to go to the front and commit, I mean, verbalize your sin and repent every Sunday until it's gone, then is it pride that keeps us from doing that? Which is another sin, isn't it? Lord God, we just come before you with a sin that has stayed. And we ask, Lord, that you, in your infinite grace, would teach us how to give it to you, that we might walk with you fully clean and loving you. May you take the walls and the barriers away from us. Make that which has kept us captive. Let us be set free from these things. Father, in your gift of Jesus, the bondage was cut. Now we need to live as if it's true. We ask for mercy, loving kindness, grace, Father, and that we might become the righteous children you've called us to become. In the name of your Son, amen.